Welcome, everybody. Again, for those of you who are new, my name's Rick Brown. I use he, him pronouns. This is the fourth session of a five-session program that we're doing this week. And the last session's this afternoon, because I have to leave early. I have to leave tomorrow. So today we're going to be talking about clean energy politics and policy. But the one that is sort of dear and dear to me, and I hope you can make it. If you can't, come find me because I have a worksheet / resource sheet for taking action. This afternoon is about taking action. So if you can't make it this afternoon, just come find me and I'll give you the sheet to work with. There's going to be a little bit of repetition today because I don't know if there are new people here. There's some context that's important, but those who've been here, hopefully you'll be okay with it. So, clean energy, policy, and politics. One of the sort of standard, you can call it memes or values or orientations that I hold around climate emergency and clean energy is think global, but act local, but act global too. We need to act at all levels. And that's part of what we're going to be talking. We're going to be talking about different levels of policy and different levels of politics today. This afternoon, we'll be talking about taking action again at all those different levels. Because like the COVID pandemic, you know, climate is kind of letting us know we're all connected, right? What happens at any part of the globe impacts us. What happens in our backyard impacts everybody else in terms of the climate issues we talked about the other day. So we need to approach this crisis from an all-of-the-above strategy. That doesn't mean everybody has to do everything. As we talked about yesterday, you know, sometimes the few small things you do in your own backyard can have viral effects that have larger significance. So don't get too hung up in, oh, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. This is about doing what you can. And particularly with policy and politics, it can be very overwhelming. And so finding the place where you have a sense of efficacy, right, where you have a sense that you can make even a small difference, that's the important thing. Not worrying about whether it's, you know, the grand big thing in the scheme of things. So I want to tell a little story. A lot of what I'm going to talk about are case studies around policy and politics from California, because that's what I know. But they, I think, apply to other situations, other communities, and other environments. So I don't know how much you all know about this, but in the early 2000s, California had passed a law to essentially deregulate the provision of electricity and energy services, which meant that instead of having a regulatory body, the California Utilities Commission, provide sort of a monopoly to a few entities to provide power, mostly investor-owned utilities, it was free-for-all. Anybody could come and offer power. There are states that have that full deregulation today, and it seems to be working okay for now, but it turned into a disaster in California because you may have heard of this company called Enron, and they basically gamed the system. And gamed it in a way where, because there wasn't that regulatory oversight, energy prices became extremely volatile, and in some cases becoming so expensive that they just couldn't afford it, and people were getting shut off. Long story short, it turned out they weren't just gaming it within the rules of the policy, they were actually breaking the law. Mm-hmm. And they eventually, you know, were found to have done that. They were put out of business, went bankrupt, lots of stuff. But one of the results of that was that the city governor at that time in California, this is around 2000, 2001, 2002, this is where the policy affects the politics, the city governor at that time, Gray Davis, was recalled, right? He was put up to a recall. He was blamed, and there's a certain extent that he was responsible, but you know how politics is. Somebody had to take the fall. He was recalled, and to to the horror of many of us in California, we elected Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it was like, oh my God, are you kidding? Is this what we've done? And we'll come back to Arnold in a second, because it turned out he actually not only wasn't as bad as he thought he might be, but he actually is a clean energy champion. He's somebody that should be seen as one of the key people in the advancing the clean energy revolution. We'll talk about that later. But while all this was going on, one of the outcomes of this deregulation piece, also PG&E, the energy company that we've talked about a lot, they also went bankrupt because they did both illegal and stupid things and were caught. And they've been bankrupt a couple times. They still seem to come back like a zombie. But anyway, won't go there. As a result of that, right, remember we talked about in policy and politics, never waste a good crisis? Well, one of the things that came out of the crisis was the passage of a law authorizing the establishment of community choice agencies. Now, we talked about them a bunch yesterday. I'm not going to go into depth about it, but we talked about it from what they do for the clean energy revolution. I want to talk a little bit about the politics side at the moment. The law basically said that cities, counties, basically political jurisdictions in California, could join together under what's called a joint powers authority and form an entity, a public entity, with a governing board made up of representatives of those entities, or in some cases, cities by themselves could form that CCA and have their city council be the governing body to get in front of or be an alternative to purchasing or generating wholesale electricity and selling it retail to the public. And the primary emphasis there was, again, accountability. People didn't trust their utilities anymore, and they wanted to have a body that was responsible to the people, right? Where voters could basically have that accountability versus some shareholder. And the second was that the CCAs were formed with this express purpose of accelerating turning the grid, making energy more clean, faster than anybody else. Now, that law was passed in 2002, but for some reason, which we'll kind of talk about, they didn't get the first CCA form until 8 years later. Okay? And the good news is, once that first CCA form got past that threshold, over the last 12 years, another 24 CCAs have now formed in California, serving 11 million customers across the state. Pretty much all the major areas of the state will have CCA. Within 2025, there's a prediction that 80% of Californians will be served by a CCA instead of by their investor-owned utility. As I said, showed yesterday, they've been extremely successful in accelerating the adoption of clean energy sources. They basically have doubled beyond what the state was requiring, and California had some very rigorous requirements around cleaning up their electricity sources, but they've doubled beyond that over that period of time. We'll come back in a second to this question of why did it take so long, because it's part of the politics part of this, but this is a success story in terms of policy, and it reinforces the lesson that I mentioned earlier that I want you to take away from here, which is crisis brings opportunity, right? We never would have gotten that law passed but for the Enron crisis, is basically the way we look at it. So as you think about, and we talked this afternoon about taking action, one of the things you really want to be looking at is, when's the next crisis in my community, and how can we take advantage of that crisis, okay? The other thing, and this is where Arnold comes in, is, and that's a picture of Arnold at the celebration I showed yesterday when we passed the million solar projects in California threshold. One of the things that resulted also is that in 2005, 2.5 years into Arnold's term, he got religion around solar. And this became his signature issue. And he was also really into hydrogen cars, but that didn't go anywhere. But he really got into solar. And he was the one who basically, you know, working with his Democratic leadership in the California legislature, passed something called the California Solar Initiative, which had as its goal to have 1 million solar roofs within 10 years. The program was pretty straightforward. It basically put into people's electricity bills a surcharge to fund incentives to build solar. So, and it was a step-down model, which is the early adopters would get more money than later as the program went along. This was extremely successful in juicing demand, right? So one of the things I've talked to you about, taking away crisis breeds opportunity. The other thing I've talked about is the critical role that market dynamics play in this acceleration of the adoption of clean energy. And this signal, this demand signal, California being the fifth largest economy in the world, maybe you didn't know that, but as a state is the fifth largest, that signal plus some other signals is what literally made the market for solar to expand exponentially over that next period of time, over the last 15 years, 17 years. The other one was in 2005, the feds, the federal government, and actually George Bush Jr. Was a leader of this. So, you know, sometimes you kind of go, oh, the Republicans. These are two Republicans who played a very important role in making the solar revolution happen. And they're not often credited as much as they should be. But he was supportive of an investment tax credit for solar, which for many years was a critical piece of the economics of solar moving forward. Basically, what this chart shows is the early years, the value of that investment tax credit was 14 cents. It went down over time as the cost of solar went down, because it was a percent. You basically got, for every dollar you invested as an investor, either as an individual, or remember I talked about this company I started, the first solar tax equity financing company. We provided the financing for these solar projects. We got 30%. Return. It's a nice thing when you're lending money and you automatically know you're going to get 30% of it back. That's a government policy that incentivized people going solar and incentivized capitalists to go solar. I remember the day we closed our first fund. It was 2007. And up to then, we'd just been getting, you know, high wealth individuals to say, okay, I'll invest in this project at this winery, or invest in this project, this school. Well, the first tax equity fund was with Wells Fargo Bank. We convinced them to put $100 million into a fund that we could then lend, and they would get those tax benefits. And of course, the money would get paid back also by the income that was generated by those projects. But when you know you have the security that 30% is going to come back in that federal tax credit. And by the way, the California Solar Initiative provided another, probably in those early years, about 20% in terms of just cash grants. In fact, one of the things that happened in 2009 to 2012 is the investment tax credit was changed to what was called direct pay, meaning because of the recession, right, that came out of 2008, to juice even further, instead of having to have a tax appetite, meaning to have a tax bill that this credit could offset as a finance person, the government just sent you the money, right? Direct pay, they sent you the cash, that 30%, and that accelerated that process. What I'm trying to go through is the different policy mechanisms that have been used to accelerate the adoption of solar. And the third one, besides the investment tax credit and the California Solar Initiative, was that Germany and Spain set up what's called a feed-in tariff. And what that tariff basically meant was, if you build a solar project anywhere in that country for a period of time, they don't have it anymore, the government will basically pay you a fixed amount significantly higher than what you would normally get. It was a feed-in tariff. You put the power into the grid, you got paid at a premium for that power, for that clean power. So three policy initiatives, different ones, one an incentive, one a tax credit, one a feed-in tariff, and that drove the manufacturing boom, right? So this is when these policies were initiated, and that's the curve of manufacturing of solar panels. But here's where everybody's kind of equal, right? China, Taiwan, Japan, Malaysia, Germany, South Korea, United States, all making about the same amount of solar panels. What happened? The Chinese said, wow, we want to be in front of this business, right? So they invested massively in manufacturing capability. And they basically took over. I did some projects with BP panels and ARCO panels in this period. But by about 2010, Chinese panels were all you could really get, right? So we'll come back to, so why did the United States not provide incentives or, to manufacturers to do the same thing, right? Why did we give up this technology, okay? Interestingly, as part of this executive order about 2 or 3 weeks ago, President Biden has tried to basically say, we need to have an industrial strategy. Because, of course, this country doesn't like industrial strategy because that's socialism, right? But now he's saying, we got to have, for national security reason, and it's under the Defense Act that he did this, for national security reason, we need to have an onshore solar manufacturing capability because of how dependent our energy is now on solar panels, right? Now, the question would be, can we catch up? Policy background. And what about battery storage? Because we've talked about the fact that the clean energy future isn't going to work without batteries, right? Because the sun only rises a certain amount of day, wind only occurs a certain amount of day. They have that intermittency issue that we talked about, so we need something that balances things. Batteries are the primary solution for that. But China currently dominates nearly every aspect of the lithium-ion supply chain, enjoying the ensuing economic and strategic advantages that come with it. They control production of more than 80% of the minerals used in EV batteries, and both through local production as well as investments they made around the world. That policy that Biden put forward also focused on trying to juice up the American battery manufacturing capability, both for EVs and for buildings and grid purposes. But as you can see with some of these lines, not a lot going on in the United States right now. Manufacturing, Tesla, has pretty huge manufacturing, battery manufacturing capability, what's called a gigafactory in Reno, Nevada. They have one in now Austin, a smaller one. But China is dominating this through the same strategy they used with solar panels. All right, that's some background. I'm going to drill down a little bit more on some of the politics issues. Let me start with that California Solar Initiative. So, great program, incentives, juices demand. You saw what happened. But it was so successful that by 2011, we'd only reached about 80% of the goal in terms of the amount of solar that we were going to incentivize, and the program ran out of money. Why did the program run out of money? Turned out that the people who were given the job to administer the incentives, the investor-owned utilities, PG&E, Southern California Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric, had basically made a mistake on their spreadsheets.
Oh.
And gave out more money per kilowatt of solar than they should have. And basically, and that's what the later investigation found out. So, a Senator Kehoe from San Diego said, well, we still need to meet this goal. Let's basically put in legislation that fills the gap. And that gap was about a $500 million gap. Now, I know those of you from small states, $500 million sounds like a lot of money. In California, it's not exactly a rounding error, but it's not that much money, okay, in terms of the California budget, which this year is somewhere close to $330 billion. But back then, it was more than $190, $200 million, so it wasn't inconsequential. At that time, California didn't have a supermajority in its legislature, meaning to pass a tax, basically a fiscal bill of this sort, you had to get a two-thirds majority. And it was, at that time, it was more like 60-40 Democrat-Republican. Even though Arnold was all in on solar, most of the Republican legislators at that time were not solar advocates. They were, most of them were climate denialists, I'll be really blunt. This is 2010, 2011. So they thought of this as a government giveaway. But the strategy that we used at that time to get this bill passed basically involved figuring out in which Republican, because we needed basically four Republican votes in the California Senate, which Republican legislators were in districts that had the highest adoption rate of solar. It turned out sunny San Diego was one of those districts. There was the senator from San Luis Obispo County, and I can't remember his name at the time. I forget your name, I'm sorry, but
Jim.
Yeah, she is from that community. And we basically went out and drummed up as much support as we could from people in those areas. We didn't try to convince everybody. We drummed up support, and this was the California Solar and Storage Association, in those specific areas to get their senators on board. On August 30th, the last day of the session, at 4:55, the session was going to end at 5. At 4:55, we needed one more vote. A guy named Nathan Fletcher from San Diego. He's now a supervisor there, actually. And he's left the Republican Party, by the way. But anyway, at that time, we needed to convince him, and we didn't have time to get him the document that he wanted from the Legislative Council to get his vote before 5 o'clock. So we convinced, one of the things, this is to kind of talk about the craziness of politics, we convinced the Senate leader to stop the clock. He was allowed to say, basically, stop the clock. We're stopping the clock, yeah. Right? Which gave us an extra 10 minutes. I literally ran, you know, from one building to another with this letter to his office to say, here, the Legislative Council has satisfied your concern. He did his vote, and we got the $500 million. The reason, I'm sharing the story to kind of pull out a couple elements that are really important. One is, Fletcher wouldn't have done this if we hadn't gotten his constituents, 200 or 300 of his constituents, to call, write, whatever. Okay, so the grassroots piece is really important. But you also have to be really creative, you know, and you have to have some miracles, you know, honestly, right? And miracles do happen, you know, if you put your, but you gotta show up, right? And showing up is the main message I wanna tell about that story. Anyway, that resulted in, you know, I think, another 200 megawatts of solar. And importantly, many of those were projects at schools. Why do you think I cared about it a lot? I had a lot of clients who, some of them could have still done the project based on their economics, but a lot of them couldn't have. But that those ones that did, and by the way, that Clovis story, those were one of them. Now, they may have still done it, but it's possible they may not have. And given that they then became sort of that tipping point school that led to 2,500 schools doing solar, if that senator had stopped the clock, right? If those constituents had... So it's, again, that's my, you know, there's all these little pieces showing up, grassroots, a little bit of miracle, tipping points are part of the dynamic in the politics versus policy piece to be thinking about. I have some other stories, but I think I'd rather go to this next discussion.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, let's do some questions, yeah.
So, how did you, at that time and since then, change the, or address the narrative that solar and wind will always require subsidy, as if the fossil fuel industry hasn't required subsidies?
God.
How have you dealt with that
perception
belief system?
Well, first of all, the subsidies pretty much have been eliminated. There still is an investment tax credit. It's gone down from that 30%. And actually, as we speak, there's negotiations. It's supposed to go down to 10% in the next 2 years. There's negotiations going on between Joe Manchin, Charles Schumer, to extend that 20% or so. So there is a subsidy there. But the notion that fossil fuels don't have subsidies is completely not true.
Right.
Okay. So that, and that part, frankly, nobody, at least in California politics, has a problem. People don't have a problem with subsidies for solar in California anymore. In terms of, that's not totally true. That actually is not totally true. But there's less of a need for subsidies at this point. So it's not, that's no longer the battle.
Those of us in red states, especially fossil fuel states,
have
to be able to deal with that. Then.
Yes, that's right. And you know, it's different. You know, it's different narratives. You know, the liberation, the freedom, choice kind of thing is one thing. In some red states where the impacts of climate are starting to get really serious, are getting people to sort of rethink the question. And then, frankly, the fact that, again, as I showed earlier, clean energy, it's hard to make the fiscal argument because clean energy is the cheapest source of energy now. There's no arguing that anymore. Even the conventional wisdom type people understand that it makes no sense to invest in a fossil fuel plant for electricity if you can do solar instead or wind instead. What is the largest producing state of renewable energy? I don't know if we were all here. Remember? It's Texas. That's a red state.
Yeah.
Right? And they're continuing to grow even more. The fastest growing of solar, most of that has been wind up to now. Mm-hmm. The fastest growing solar state is Texas. West Texas is great for solar. So, I'm not trying to say it's easy, but part of that dynamic is really not as much as it used to be. Yeah.
I have an uncle with a ranch in West Texas. Mm-hmm. I visited him 15 years ago. All the oil wells out there gone.
Yeah.
Went there 5 years ago. All these windmills.
Yeah.
I said, Uncle David, this is wonderful. He said most of the electricity is going into the production, into the fracking process. These windmills. I said, wow, this is cool. Look at all these windmills here in West Texas.
Yeah.
So that energy is being used
by
the fossil fuel companies. So I.
Yeah. Why are they doing that? Because it's cheaper.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Now, so the point is the economics are there. That's what I was trying to say the other day.
Yeah.
I'm not telling this first story around those issues. I'm trying to talk about the political intersects. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Emery?
Yeah. Would you
be so kind to say just a touch on geothermal?
Not really, because I can't say a whole lot about it other than I do think it's a technology that is going to see some, you know, pretty rapid growth because it is a base fuel, meaning it's not intermittent. One interesting story is, as I mentioned to you,
yeah,
in my community we have some geysers, and so we have a lot of geothermal out of that. About 60% of our power comes through geothermal. But in order to maintain, one of the problems we have in California is water. And to make geothermal power, you have to heat up water. So our local supervisors came up with an interesting idea. One of the sources of water is that can't be drunken, is wastewater.
Mm-hmm.
So basically we built a 60-mile pipe from our major wastewater treatment plant, and we put our stuff down into the geysers, and that's how we keep the power going. But it's too technical for, and it's not really a political issue, so not really appropriate. Yeah.
Where is nuclear in this?
Yeah, we talked the other day. It's interesting. Up until 12, 18 months ago, nobody was talking about nuclear being, because the costs, both the building, the amount of time it takes to build nuclear, and the cost of disposing of the waste is just prohibitive.
Right.
But because there's this recognition that we need to accelerate, right, the reduction in emissions, and we have nuclear plants today that are operating,
right,
people who never would have supported continuation in her backyard, they're talking about a plant that was going to close, that's on the San Andreas Fault, by the way, that was going to be closed down in 2025. They're talking about extending it another 3 years. There are new small nuclear technologies, but they're still at a very pilot stage, and they're not going to get built in time for what we need in our terms of reversing the emissions. But maybe for the long term, that may come back as a technology. The politics, though, on that are going to be pretty tough, because nobody wants the waste. So you can't have nuclear if you can't put the spent rods somewhere. And so, politically, I think that's going to be a big obstacle. Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you to just sit and turn with two other people and start doing I've given you some stories about various political dynamics I've dealt with in California. This gentleman over here talked about the argument, the political dynamics associated in more red states around subsidies and fossil fuels and so forth. What do you know about the political dynamics around clean energy and climate where you live? Either at a city level, county level, school district, state, whatever, but your local area. What do you know about the political dynamics around these issues? Take about 5 to 7 minutes to share with two other people. And then we'll have let's see what other people experience.
I have to take this one from
my booty's good.
There you go.
So that's an example.
All right. Okay. What are some of the dynamics that came up in your stories with each other? Just let's talk about a few of them.
Inexpensive hydropower.
Inexpensive hydro. Oh, damn it. These pens. I'll find one. Here, I think there's one up here. Well, and let me just say, we talked a little bit about this before. Hydro is not uniformly bad. I mean, hydro is a clean energy. So, my personal opinion is getting too worked up about getting involved in fighting hydro may not be the most important issue. There may be other opportunities. Now, that's not to say there might, new dams in certain places are, pretty damaging for other reasons, but at least it's not, emitting the kind of emissions that fossil plants would do. Other dynamics.
So one thing that was interesting to me is a restraint is some zoning and regulation that is actually, what did we say? Union, keeping union jobs.
Right, yeah. Let me talk a little bit about that. California has a really terrible struggle right now, where because the largest employer of unionized workers in California is who? The IOUs, the investment. So basically, and we all, I don't want to repeat the whole thing we've done before, but you understand why IOUs don't want customer-based distributed energy. They're okay now with building massive, you know, solar and wind plants, which is great. But as we saw the other day, we need the mix, or we're not going to get there. And so, unfortunately, they've been able to get the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in California to basically oppose efforts to expand or allow distributed solar to expand. This is a real, and one of the other dynamics is that anybody belong or a contributor to Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC? On a national level, NRDC is great around clean energy. In California, they've taken the position that they oppose, they're pretty much trying to kill customer-based solar, because they made a deal with labor and with primarily the utilities that if those folks don't oppose their environmental efforts in other areas, in other political areas, they will join up with them.
Wow.
It's a major conflict within NRDC, but the California chapter is basically the opponent, the adversary.
Wow.
And that's really not fun. I mean, just all the other environmental organizations are like, what the, but that is it. It's a difficult dynamic. And difficult for me because a big part of my life, I in my consulting business before I got to solar, I worked with a lot of unions as a strategy consultant. And I've actually been able to use that to bring other unions into the political dynamics so it doesn't just look like a, union versus environmentalist thing. It's not that clear. And the other part is that there are locals. I mean, my company, because we do public jobs, a majority of our jobs are union contracts, right? We hire IBEW. Those folks and those locals, basically have told me, Rick, I'd love to be able to make a big deal about it, but the dinosaurs are in charge at IBEW, and those are the ones who are involved with the utilities. So it's complex, but politics is not easy. There are these dynamics. A few other dynamics. Yeah?
I think in my red state and my, fairly red town, only cheaper costs would bring people. There's a lot of climate denial.
Right.
There's a lot of, probably handout things, but also other issues we care about more.
Right.
Only cheap.
That's great, right? Because we are the cheapest.
How do you get that across?
That's an education process, right? I don't think you were here for the Clovis School District story, but where I was able to convince the head of the Tea Party to promote a bond measure, tax measure, because he was going to save the school money.
Okay,
right?
Well.
So there are, you just have, it's a education process. It's not a one and done, right? That's the other, sort of general principle here. You can't be in this for the short term. You got to be in it for at least the medium term, because, this education process does take some time. That Clovis School District, it took me 2.5 years from the day I first started till the night that the board approved the project, which also happened to be the night that Pablo Sandoval hit 3 home runs during the World Series. And of course, everybody in the audience was looking at their phones. I remember what was happening in the World Series, and people were going, and the board members are going, what is going on? But they did pass the solar bill. Anyway, gotta have some fun with this. Couple more dynamics, yeah.
Well, kind of in line with that is the idea of freedom of choice
can
sometimes turn climate deniers and red thinking you use it.
Yeah, that's a really important one. These are the two that, you know, are going to be the most useful in those environments. And yeah.
So the question, who are the experts?
Right.
When the traditional experts, the policy and legislative folks are fossil fuel folks.
Right. Yeah.
And you've talked about this week, don't use the word alternative energy.
Right.
But I'm leading here thinking, how do we get more perception that experts really are experts?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a way.
Not just advocates.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of that is finding out, you know, who are the quote unquote, you know, objective folks. So we do have these national labs in this country. Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, there's Pacific National Lab, there's National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. And I have been able to, even though they're federal government, you know, I have been able to use data from those places to influence legislators. I'm not saying it's always, you know, gonna work, but those sources are very, very useful. And there are, you know, this is where the research comes in. Who are the sources of information besides lobbyists? Although it's important to know who those are also, who support the particular legislator target, and particularly folks, you know, some of the Chamber of Commerce people who don't typically support progressive kinds of causes because of these issues. You know, we were able to, one of the agencies that we worked with that really made a difference is the Association of California Water Agencies. They were a mix of private and public companies, okay? But they historically have been very, very, very conservative on using clean energy to run their operations. Over a 3-year period, including me going to conferences and schmoozing, we were able to get the general manager of the Eastern Water Municipal District, which is the second largest water agency in California after MWD, which you've all heard about from Chinatown, the movie Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Right? Anybody remember Chinatown? If you haven't, it's a great movie. But EMWD was, within the water agency world, similar to Clovis in the school world. And they had a lot of influence because it was one of the largest. It was also one of the most conservative. We did one little project with them, you know, one little 500 kilowatt project, and it worked. They saved money. And over time, you know, and now they're our biggest client, and they're doing battery storage, and, you know, they're doing megawatts and megawatts of projects, and we have, you know, we'll be continuing to do that. And as the success of those projects occur, the word gets out, right? And they become the expert, right? Not the consultant or whatever. So it's often working those networks, but again, over time, right? That's the issue. Okay. I'm sure there's more there. I just have a few more things I want to cover, and then we'll let you go for lunch. What I want to talk about is overcoming doomism, right? Because, you know, doing this work can be very frustrating, right? And thinking about the climate can be kind of scary, right? Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about, you know, if you can come out of that state of doom and gloom, it's going to be much easier to address and figure out strategies to engage the positive political dynamics and get around the negative ones. Doomism is problematic for 4 reasons. One, it plays into apocalyptic fatigue, right? We can really go down that rabbit hole and pretty much sit there and never come out. And that's not going to help anybody. It also saps people of agency, that sense that that people can actually make something happen, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not helpful either. It could lead to also the what the hell effect, right? Mm-hmm. I just, you know, it's too much, I can't handle it. And by reinforcing that everyone is not doing enough, Because that's the other problem. You look at your neighbors, you look at your friends, and you start blaming people, which we talked about the other day. That doesn't get here. Everybody's not doing enough. It reinforces the social norm that doing nothing is the way we all do things, right? It becomes the norm, right? And we don't want to fall into those traps. So, as Greta said, don't worry about whether you're feeling doom and gloom, right? Do something. Just act. Even if you're feeling gloomy, just act. Because that's what's going to get you energized, give you agency, get you from, you know, that what the hell effect, and so forth. One of the ways in which the fossil fuel folks and other agents of predatory delay, that's the term I use, is to move people towards doom and gloom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's their psychological strategy, right? Their political strategy is to make you feel that doomism. And they do it with subtle and not so subtle ways. We don't have to get into all the ways they are, but when you recognize in yourself that feeling, remember where it's coming from. And that can help you come around to, I'm not going to let that do that to me. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm gonna listen to Greta. Right? Don't listen to Exxon. Now, there are a lot of reasons for hope. You know, from that first city that went CCA in 2010, there are now 200 in California. As I said before, by 2025, 80% of California will be getting their power from an agency that is offering them 100% clean energy. They don't have to put solar panels on their roof, right? And even their least clean energy is going to be 20 to 30% more than what they get from their utility, right? So I'm pushing CCA. In 2019, the city of Berkeley passed a law, yay Berkeley, power to the people, passed a law banning use of gas appliances in all new construction. 3 years later, there are now 71 communities in California, including Los Angeles, and New York City just passed a ban.
So did Washington State.
So did Washington State?
Yeah.
All right, go to Washington. Yeah. There is, as bad as things got with Joe Manchin this year, there still is, you know, the bipartisan infrastructure plan did put significant money into promoting electric vehicles, promoting gas, heat pump technology, other kinds of climate. It was the biggest money ever for fighting climate. Okay, and there is now hope that Schumer and Manchin will come up with a deal to put another $300 billion into climate-fighting kinds of stuff. Now, there's also going to be money for stupid stuff, but anyway, that's part of politics, right? Better a half a loaf than none. One more reason that's happening is because, in fact, I talked about Chamber of Commerce's, big business is starting to see that the bottom line is impacted by these issues. And the huge growth in ESG funding and retirement, you know, people putting their money, moving their money into instruments, into securities, into bonds, whatever, that focus on the environment and climate issues. That's a huge change that's gone on in the last 2-3 years. Now, there is something called climate hypocrisy. New term, you're hearing it here first, which is 2 years ago, Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, right, the fund that has more money in it than all of South America, right, said climate is the most important issue. All of our investments are going to be, you know, focused on climate, right? Well, 2 weeks ago he was like, well, maybe not, you know, maybe shareholder returns is kind of important also. The stupid thing about that is, I can just tell you, for me, who's been doing this for 30 years, I'm doing a hell of a lot better than my friends who didn't have socially responsible investing and ESG investing. So, again, you make money doing this stuff. It's not, you know, it's kind of stupid. But we can have further discussion around that. And the other reason for the shift in perspective, because I do think we are moving in that direction, is that the generation coming up into adulthood, Generation Z or whoever, whatever the term is, a growing number of them are saying they don't want to work for companies. They don't want to work in jobs that don't have climate consciousness. Because they get it, right? They see it. They've been growing up with it. And that will change. That will be, in some ways, the biggest motivator of change. We just need to make sure they get out and vote in the midterms,
yep.
Right? Exactly. And they need to make sure we get out and vote also in the midterms. So that's some of the reasons I have hope. And one more, does activism work?
1 minute.
Right? There was a recent study that investigated 323 social change campaigns around the world between 1900 and 2006. They found that around 80% were either partially or completely successful. And it only took 3.5% of the population being actively engaged to make a difference. Okay? So if it's your county, right, and your county has 100,000 people, you only need to get 3,500 people involved, and you'll make that change. Right? If it's your city and it only has 10,000 people, you only need 350 people to get involved. It's doable. In Petaluma right now, we have something called the Cool Block Program, where we are on a block-by-block basis getting people organized around disaster preparedness. I mean, that's another issue, by the way, that you can hook people into as to why they should be thinking about climate. Because people don't, they know that disasters are coming. So you start with that. Then you talk to them about solar and storage and water conservation, et cetera, et cetera. So we're doing that in Petaluma, and we've already got 300 blocks signed up out of the 1,200 blocks in the city, where people are getting together with their neighbors to think about strategies to reduce their carbon emissions, to make them more, resilient. Okay, and then how do you get involved? That's this afternoon, but here are some of the organizations that nationally make sense. It's important for you to find out who are doing this work politically, locally, right? And again, if you put your name and state where you are, I'll do some research and see who I could, if I know of who are the good organizations in your area, I can tell you about that. And, there's Joe Manchin. But there's one thing I want to show on this slide. When Joe Manchin came outside, when the deal fell apart, right, on the big, the big plan, the Democrats were trying to get across, He told reporters that he had no intention of voting for any social policy and climate change bill that costs more than $1.5 trillion over 10 years. His advice for Democrats who want a larger package is elect more liberals. I think we should take his advice. I mean, that's what it's about, folks. I mean, that is what it's about. It's not really liberals, obviously. There are all kinds of people. We need to elect people who get it. Who get this issue, right? Who understand what's going on. So, again, I'm going to repeat what I said before. Calling for these changes is not radical, right? It's deeply sane. We want to be on the side of sanity, okay? So, this afternoon, we're going to get really granular about specific actions you can take at the individual, community, state, federal level. You don't have to do them all. Just pick, it's like a menu. You can pick which ones fit your sense of agency, your sense of efficacy, where you can get things done. All right, I'm getting in the way of lunch. Go have lunch.